Oak session number 12376, reel 3.
Mr. Simpson, reel 3. You tell me about being the last one into Broadway with the water.
Well, we were last in because it wasn't until long after the first airplane had landed that they sent back this signal they wanted water. So I was the reserve airplane and was told to take in water. And they gave me a small bowser full of water and several 50-gallon drums of water, and I took these in, delighted to be having my first operational flight in command, landed at Broadway long after everybody else, and a Chindit bristling with guns and knives and things opened the door and said, "Well, what have you got for him?" I said, "I've got your water," very pleased with myself. "Water? What the hell do you brought water for?" "Well, we went men and ammunition." So I said, "Well, I'm terribly sorry, I've only got water." So he said, "Well, you'd better get out of here quickly because dawn not far away and you've got to be off the strip." And I said, "Well, you get this water off before I can't get off with it on." So we rolled out the 50-gallon drums onto the airfield and then tried to get the bowser out, but there was no way we could get it through the door, manhandling it. We turned on the tap to get out rid of as much of it, left the tap on, and he said, shouted me, "Go on, off you go, off you go." So I eventually got him to get some men to manhandle it to the front of the airplane, where my crew lashed it down, and we tried to get off. Now, I had completely disorientated by the kerfuffle, and the early morning mist had come down, and I suddenly spotted two lights, and it must be the runway lights, so we lined up with those, and I said, "We'll have to open up on the throttle before we let go," and I just about got full power, about to let go, and a man rushed in front with a torch, waving at me. I shut down the engine, throttled back, and he said, "These are the last two lights on the runway. You're facing the wrong way." I often wished I could meet that man because, my goodness me, he saved me from an awful catastrophe. Anyway, we turned around and took off. And again, in the confusion, I'd completely forgotten that immediately after takeoff, I had to make a 15-degree turn to the right. And this I didn't do. The first I knew was I could hear the trees battering the bottom of the airplane, and that brought it all back to me in a flash. And so I did a stall turn steeply to the right and pulled it up, and again the Lakota was marvellous. It answered the call. And when I got back to the base, the fitter and the engineer were looking, "Where have you been, sir?" And I said, "Well, the whole little cowling were full of twigs and leaves and so on." But there was no problem from the Dakota. It didn't take any amount of abuse like that.
Can you tell me about the problems of carrying mules in Dakotas?
Well, the problem with mules is that they are mulish and difficult to handle. And what they did was they fixed up stalls made out of bamboos in the aircraft, and you somehow got the mules on board and then lashed them into position. And they were, I think they were cramming up to six mules in there. And they occasionally caused a lot of trouble. One had broken loose in the airplane. And the captain was most upset to find the troops shooting it inside his airplane, trying to kill this mule with bullets flying all over the place. Anyway, they managed to shoot it, and it was all right. Then
there was one occasion when Wingate had a problem with a mule.
Oh, yes. We were at this strip waiting to take off, and Wingate, with his posse of red tabs, was inspecting the operation, and the troops were having particular trouble with one mule who just did not want to walk up the ramp, and they were cursing and swearing. And General Wingate, a very religious man, he went and tore them off a strip for using that sort of language, and it's quite unnecessary. I'll show you how to do it. So he took the mule's halter and led it around the airplane, chatting amicably to it all the time and telling him what a good fellow he was and all this sort of thing. And then up the ramp, and still the mule refused to go and dug his 4 feet, and so he turned around and walked it around the airplane. I think he did that 3 times, and still the mule wouldn't board. And then he said, "Come on, you phone, get on, get behind this thing." And all his red tabs were unused to this sort of work, but they were all heaving and pushing. And then he could see the crew of Sergeant Eku laughing away, and the captain was Sergeant Wally Kimball, a Rhodesian, and he was laughing. And Wingate said, "Come on, you three, help as well." And he said, "No, sir, I'm supposed to fly that aeroplane. If I get kicked by a mule, then that aeroplane doesn't go." So they didn't help, but they didn't get the mule on board either.
Were you anywhere near Wingate when he was lost?
Yes. On the day he was lost, I'd been flying, and I was at Imphal, and Group Captain Donaldson, who was the wing commander, the commander of all the squadron in the wing, he said, "Simpson, have you finished for the day?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, hang on, I might have something for you to do." So, yes, sir, and I hung around, and then after about an hour he came and said, "I'd off you go. I thought I might have a VIP for you, but he's decided to go some other form of transport." It was a particularly bad day for weather. I noted it in my logbook. I noted in there that returned via Silchar. And what happened was Silchar was west of the hills, and if you could get near Silchar, then you knew that you could come down, because it was all flat land around there. So we came back, and there we suddenly spotted Silchar, descended through a hole in the clouds until we were below cloud, and then headed for home. And as we came out of the cloud at the bottom, to my left, that is to the east of us, I could see another airplane, a Mitchell, coming down. And I said to the crew, "I hope he knows where he is, because he's very close to the hills." And off we went, and thought no more of it. Now, we didn't know for a week after Wingate had been killed that he had been killed, and then we were told that he'd been killed flying out of Imphal in a Mitchell. And I said, "Well, I know where he is. He's at Bishanpur, because that's where I had seen him, and he was going straight in there." Now, why he was going down, I don't know, but he was on the wrong side of the hills.
Can you make some kind of comparison between the different landing strips that the Chindits use from the point of view of the problems that RAF had of getting in and out?
Well, all the strips had problems, basically, at one end or the other. At hills, or at one end, and that was normally not the landing. The landing ends were generally good, except at Blackpool, where they left trees on the approach. Most of them had hills on one end or the other. And like Broadway, a takeoff involved a 15-degree turn to the right. Aberdeen, if you overshot, you had to make a 30-degree turn to port and fly up the valley. It didn't normally affect you if your landing was all right at Aberdeen, because we landed one way and took off the other way, so that you were using the good approach end for both takeoff and landing. White City was a very short strip. Charingi was very small, and they were only used for a very short time, both of them, Charingi and White City. Aberdeen was in use for a long, long time, and was a very good strip, good approaches, and apart from that disadvantage if you overshot. And we had one chap with whom I did a lot of my early flying, a New Zealander called Ray Melsop, and for some reason or other he overshot at Aberdeen and went straight on and hit the hill instead of going up the valley.
You're telling me that the Bofors at Blackpool had been captured by the Japanese?
Yes, they were captured intact, and they were firing open sights.
You were also telling me earlier about the control of the aircraft going into the landing strips and the good work that various individuals did there.
Yes, the one chap in particular, Sir Robert Thompson, he was very good at Aberdeen, and he had a wonderfully calming voice, and he had a lovely sense of humour, and people would arrive excited and all wanting to land, and he had to get them into some semblance of a pattern, because he had to get airplanes off and down on the same strip, landing one way and taking off in the opposite direction, and he had to build all this, and he did this remarkably well. I have a feeling that he was decorated for that work which he did there, which certainly was well deserved, because although as Fatty would have said that's what he was in for, but he wouldn't have decorated him. But he was very, very good indeed.
You were also telling me earlier about your admiration for the resilience of the West Yorkshire troops that you came across.
Yes.
Who were in the Arakan.
It was impressive, because these chaps had 6 years overseas experience. They'd been through East Africa, they'd been through the desert, they'd been overseas for a long time. They were in the Arakan, they were in the admin box, which was a terrible place for them, and we were picking them up and then going to fly them up to Imphal, which was just starting to be besieged. And as long as they had a cup of cha and a cigarette, and they didn't mind, they just carried on. They never complained about anything seriously. A wonderful spirit that they had, these troops. Another marvellous discipline. I remember one occasion we were taking troops and mules into a landing strip, and they were in charge of a sergeant in the Black Watch, who had a wonderful little wax moustache. I think he'd drunk most of the men's rum ration, because he was certainly high, and he was climbing up the little ladder into the door at the front of the airplane, because I didn't like crawling up through the mule's legs, and went in that way. As we were going up the steps, I heard a click, and I realised that he'd primed his Sten gun. I said, "Unload that Sten gun. You're not climbing up this ladder with me, behind me with a Sten gun, because they're notoriously light on the trigger." So he did as he was told, and when we got to the top, he said he told the troops that if we were attacked by fighters, they were on their own and they would have to fight their way out of it, and because the crew had parachutes and they would be jumping right up. So I thought, well, it's about time somebody reassured these troops, and I went to them. They were all sitting there feeling rather glum. They hadn't had their full rum ration, and they'd been told that in the event of an emergency they would be left in this aeroplane on their own. And still they went. It was what amazed me, and if somebody had told me that, I think I should have been hard pushed to find it within me to go aboard. But they did just as they were told, and I reassured them that in the event of a problem, we would be with them, and we'd be all in the problem together, and we wouldn't use our parachutes, and they brightened up a lot at that.
How did you finish your tour with that squadron?
Well, I finished my 500 hours, and then what normally happened after you'd done a tour, you went off to the hill station for a fortnight, and everybody had late night parties and little sleep, and came back refreshed in mind, if not in body. However, it was decided that they would introduce a new scheme, and they built a hill station up in Kashmir. We lived on houseboats, and then they built a base camp at about 11,000 feet, and from the base camp you could go on into Gilgit and do some skiing and mountain climbing, and on arrival you were given a medical, and then at the end of your fortnight you were given another medical to show how much more beneficial this was than going to the hill station. When I arrived, the medical officer wouldn't allow me to do anything, because I was suffering from chronic heat exhaustion, I have an unfortunate defect in that I don't sweat. When we're going to the mess at night in Burma, and in half an hour everybody's bush jackets would be soaking wet and mine would stay dry as a board. So that affected my health. Anyway, I spent 6 weeks up in Kashmir and returned to the squadron, and to find that I'd been posted to do some training. I was very disappointed not to stay on the squadron, but somebody had to do the training and I was sent to do some.
Why were you so disappointed?
Why was I?
So disappointed.
Well, because I like operational flying, and that was why I joined the Air Force. And
Was it exhilarating to do these operations in Burma?
Were they?
Was it exhilarating to do these operations?
Well, it was not so much exhilarating, it's so much as a challenge which you had to meet and beat. Basically, of course, it was the weather, which was, you had to learn how to handle your aeroplane in fiendish weather conditions. And then, having found that you were near, you had to be able to get down and do your drop, or even to get back to base. You see, we had no landing aids. We just had to find these places, and that was tremendously exhilarating. And in that sense, the achievement of doing it was marvellous. I must remember that I was only 20, and I only had, about less than 1,000 hours at the end of my tour. And it was a great achievement, I think.
Do you think that 500 hours was the correct length for a tour of duty?
I think it was reasonable. It took a few months, and then you could go off and have a fortnight's leave and come back and do some more. We had one chap that just went on and on and on, a fellow called Woody Whiz. And he ultimately got a DFC, which was very well deserved, because he had a wonderful attitude, and nothing ever perturbed him. And very few of our people ever got perturbed at all. I think it was all Fatty's attitude right at the very beginning. Everybody got on very well. Tremendous esprit de corps. I can't remember anybody on the squadron that he didn't get on with. And similarly with the ground crew, they were very good. And it's shown up, we have these squadron reunions, and it's not just air crew that go, it's the ground staff that go. And that, I think, is very important.
One thing that I'd like to put on tape is what you were telling me earlier off tape about how you got onto this squadron in the first place by adopting certain stubborn tactics at Pune.
Yes.
Can you repeat that? I think that was in October 1943.
I landed in Pune, having been airlifted from Jerusalem, Lida, in a Liberator on delivery flight. And Pune was a holding unit for aircrew. And a lot of them were, like myself, Blenheim trained crews. The Blenheim was non-operational, and there was nothing for them to do except fly these Blenheims on army calibration flights, photographic flights, MET flights, and so on and so forth. And then there's another little bit of variety. They introduced jungle training, and they took you out in a jeep and dropped you and said, find your own way home. And I thought, well, this is getting me nowhere near operational flying. So I'd made up my mind I was not going to do a jungle training course. I was going to have a little mutiny of my own. So when I was posted to do the jungle course, I just lay on my bed and refused to do so. And when the CO came around on his morning inspections, they're fussy little people, the COs at these places. They've got nothing to do and they'd be busy. And it came in, CO's inspection. There should have been nobody in the hut, and I was lying on my bed reading. And they walked up to my bed, the CO's inspection. I didn't move. What are you doing? Reading. What are you supposed to be doing? Reading. And I deliberately didn't say so, and not that I'm an out bolshy type normally, but something had to be done. Anyway, what's your name? Simpson. And they checked her out. You're supposed to be on a jungle course. I said, no, I'm supposed to be posted to a squadron. I was posted to a squadron within 2 days. I went up to 194 squadron. And I think probably the only one that was lucky enough to get on a squadron from Pune for a long time.
Had you known that that would be the consequence of adopting those insubordinate tactics?
No, I didn't. It was just intuitive that I had to do something to be different. And that was the way to do it. And thinking it out, it's a logical thing to do. If you've got a CEO of a place like that and you've got somebody that causes trouble, the best thing to do is to get rid of him. So they sent me to a squadron. And I'm not a rebellious person by nature, by any means.